Welcome to Women Kicking Glass, the only radio show on OC Talk Radio dedicated to empowering women to be the best leaders they can be in any endeavor they choose. Patty Grimm is our host and interviews top women in a variety of fields to help women grow, learn, and lean in together. Patty has over 25 years of experience in primarily male-dominated fields in senior-level management positions. Patty is the owner of Advantage Training Limited, an organizational leadership team training company. She recently released her new book for women called Quiet Women Never Changed History. Be strong, stand out, and stand up. With the subtitle, Let's Go Kick Some Glass.
And that's exactly what we're going to do with Patty and her guest today here.
Wow, and we have two powerhouse women in the studio today, so we're going to be talking to both of them. So welcome, everybody, and hope you're having a great week. I've got two great guests with me today. I have Linda Adams and Abby Cuno Chavez. Cuno Chavez. They're both
mouthful.
Partners of an all-female consulting firm based in Denver. They actually traveled here, one from El Paso for a client and one from Denver, traveled all the way here to be on the show today. And they're a boutique consulting firm that assists boards, executives, and HR leaders build effective teams, align their leaders, and really enable their organization to be the best they can be. Linda has over 40 years experience and founded Trispective Group.
That's correct. And
she's got experience with Ford, PepsiCo, Level 3 Communications, and founded the group in 2008, which mm-hmm. we said is not the best time to start a business.
Nope.
And then Abby has an extensive experience working in talent management for a lot of different companies, Target, Accenture, Newmont Mining Company and Corporation, a very large global corporation. And they are both the authors, or two of the authors, of the book The Loyalist Team, How Trust, Candor, and Authenticity Create Great Organizations. So we're going to talk a lot about how leaders overall, not just women, but all leaders, can create outstanding teams and how that authenticity, trust, and candor really delivers in performance results. So first off, Linda, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got to here?
So it's been an interesting journey. I spent about 30 years in corporate HR, started with Ford Motor Company, and then here in the States, as you mentioned, worked for PepsiCo and Level 3, my last gig being the head of HR, global head of HR for that company. And while there, I met two of my co-founders, Audrey and Rebecca, who were involved with me in creating and building the HR function at Level 3. And in our work there, we did a lot around leadership development.
Mm-hmm.
It was a startup at the time. Maybe cheated a little bit because it was a $14 billion startup.
But that's a big startup.
But we really were fortunate to have the opportunity to build that HR function from the ground up with really no constraints. And as we built that function, came to understand that that's really where our passion lay.
Yeah.
And the opportunity to really help leaders and teams touch and find that potential and really bring it forward. And so we made a decision to go it on our own, and that's what we did in 2008.
In the middle of a recession.
Yep.
I'm sure your family said you were crazy, all kinds of things. I know when I left banking, my father really looked at me and said, honey, you're 29 years old, you're vice president of a large California bank. Why would you leave the security of a company like that to run your own company? You must be crazy.
Well, we were really lucky. We all three of us have amazing families.
Yeah.
At the time, though, all three of us were also the primary breadwinners.
Me too.
In our families.
Yeah.
And so it was a really big step out. But,
yeah.
Nothing but support from,
awesome.
From everyone, from husbands, kids, parents.
Yeah.
Friends, absolutely supportive.
Awesome. That really helps. And how about you, Abby? You've had an interesting career.
Yeah. So, you know, I found my passion when I was educating. I was a teacher.
Me too. Started as a teacher.
Many did who are in our field. And I think it's because what we have is we have a love for changing people's lives. And we know we have the ability to do it through helping them learn and grow.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, though. As I was doing that, I realized I'm never going to even be able to buy a house. Like I thought, I can't make enough money to do this. And I had one of my kids in my class, mom did what I do now.
Yeah.
And I sat down with her and I said, tell me more. And she did. And I ended up going to graduate school in Minneapolis and got a degree in organization development. And from there, that's when I started working at Target headquarters in their leadership group.
Right.
From there, went to work for Accenture and was a business consultant there
right.
in the human performance space for 8 years. And from there, went to work for Newmont Mining, which was my client. And I had been working with them on a big three-way merger of a company in Australia, a big global merger they were doing on the human performance side of things. And yeah. they offered me a job.
Yeah.
And I jumped into mining and I thought,
I don't know anything about mining.
I know nothing about mining.
But I know about teams and people.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, from there, formed a partnership with Tracevective and who are now my partners. They did a ton of work for us.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky enough to be able to do the work I love doing now.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's finding that passion. I know a lot of women that may be listening or men that are possibly listening. Maybe you're working in a corporation right now. Maybe you're a teacher, but you have this passion that you want to pursue and you know you can do something bigger, better, and greater. And I loved your question to somebody that was doing what you wanted to do and just simply saying, tell me more.
Yep.
How did you get here? And you went and got your degree and did all the kinds of things and look where the two of you are today. So it's sometimes hard to take that leap, but it sounds like we all made the right decision.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So a little bit about the book. So teams are critically important in today's environment, especially when things are so disruptive that everybody's being Uberized now, which used to be a popular term, but may not be today because of all the things that have gone on with the CEO. But this still became a term of everybody can lose their competitive advantage in seconds.
Yeah.
Somebody can come along and literally take it out from under you. And teams are the way to drive that that innovation. So what are the characteristics of a great team that you've seen from your research for the book? What are some of the characteristics?
So for us, we label the highest performing teams loyalist teams, which is where the name of the book comes from.
So that's the top is the loyalist
Absolutely.
Team. And the bottom is the?
Saboteur team.
The saboteur team. Is that below dysfunctional team?
That is like.
That is the dysfunctional
that,
yes. team.
That is a dysfunctional team. That's
Wildly
like rock bottom.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't get much worse than that. And the other label we have for that is Team Hell.
Team Hell.
Yes.
Wow. How many people have been on Team Hell?
Well,
right here.
In our work, we know that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% of the teams that we work with. So that's a pretty significant number.
Yeah.
On the top end, the loyalist team, about 15% of the teams that we work with are in that category. And I would just encourage listeners to pause for a moment and think about the best team they've ever been on. And what were some of the characteristics of that? What made it their dream team?
Right.
And they will come up with
yeah.
the characteristics of a loyalist team. There's trust, there's engagement, there's collaboration, there's fun, there's learning, there's a lack of fear.
There's common purpose.
Absolutely. Common goals are a really big attribute
right.
Of loyalist teams. And this notion of, I can't fail because you have my back and you won't let me fail.
Yeah.
I get to do my best work.
Yeah.
And on saboteur teams, and I know having been on them, you know, Sunday afternoon, you start to get that knot in your gut. It's
yeah.
like, geez, I got to go in there tomorrow.
You're driving to work like this.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my, I have to face these people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You dread Sunday. You dread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dread Sunday evening. Because
yeah.
you know what's coming the next day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then on loyalist teams, it's like, that's where my friends are. I can't
yeah.
wait to get there. I can't wait to
yeah.
share this idea I had over the weekend. I can't wait to hear what's going on.
And so all the creativity and innovation comes out from that loyalist team. And what's interesting is probably you've seen this research. Gallup says that only 32% of the average workforce individuals in America are actively engaged.
Absolutely.
And they estimated that's $450 billion of lost revenue to corporations in the United States because their teams are saboteurs or mm-hmm. their teams from hell. Did you call them teams from hell? Or
Team
call
hell.
Team,
team
hell.
Hell.
I was trying to remember, is that my word? Because I have a tendency to swear a little bit.
I like it, though.
Teams from hell. You know, that it's costly to business. It's very costly to business. And I know I'm a big fan of the Wisdom of Team book by Kazimbach and Smith. And their definition of a high-performance team is a team with a common purpose, a common approach to operating,
yep.
that for which they hold each other mutually accountable.
Absolutely.
Not just looking to the leader.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So what are some? So let's talk about the character, the 14 types that you talk about in the book. We talked about a couple of them, but let's talk specifically about. Let's maybe start at the bottom with a saboteur team. Is that where you want to start?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's do it. So I think Linda described some of the characteristics of a saboteur team, but what we really see there is people looking out for themselves, right? They are often looking for ways to undermine others.
Mm-hmm.
They don't trust others. They don't share information readily. They are really in it for themselves. What would you add to that, Linda?
So I think members of saboteur teams see the whole relationship as a zero-sum game. So in order
so if you win, I lose.
Absolutely.
Yep. Absolutely.
Definitely there.
Okay.
And if you're spending more time watching your back than doing your work, you're clearly on a saboteur team.
And you have zero innovation.
None whatsoever.
Because I'm not going to innovate and share my idea with you if there's any way that you might get credit.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the whole idea of CYA, right? I'm going to document everything.
Cover your...
I'm going to cover my
S.
butt, right? Exactly. I am going to cover it, and I'm going to make sure that I'm okay. I'm going to take care of myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked in an organization where we started out with this great culture, and we actually had a leader came in that destroyed it and put in place that kind of environment and culture where literally if you help somebody else, you were penalized in your performance review.
Yep.
So that's just the worst of all things. So we've got the saboteur team. What's next?
So next is benign saboteur.
Benign saboteur.
Yes. And the difference between benign saboteur and saboteur, one of the biggest differences, is you can't be a passive saboteur. There's no way I accidentally threw you under the bus and don't know how you got there.
Excuse me, there are tracks on your back.
and my footprint is on your butt. Other than that, I don't know how it happened. But benign saboteur space really is very passive. It's like make yourself a smaller target as possible. Do what needs to be done. Don't raise your hand. You know, don't rock the boat. Stay in your lane. And while I don't have any ill intent toward you, I'm not going to engage in any proactive way. And the way I think of benign saboteur teams is the sum of the parts of a benign saboteur team is always less than the whole. So there's something left on the table with benign saboteurs.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
Well, and the reason that we still label them saboteurs is really because there is no added value to the silo approach.
Yeah, so it's the organizational silos where you've got research and production and finance and marketing, and every organization is this separate little, like a corn silo in Nebraska or someplace.
Yep.
So it's just this little contained area, and you don't go outside your boundaries.
No, exactly. Wouldn't dare.
Yeah. And innovation, again, innovation does not come from that kind of a team.
Yep.
So what's the next one? Are we getting better?
We're getting better, and we're getting pretty good. And those are situational loyalist teams.
Okay.
Where more often than not, things are going really well. There's pockets of trust. There's high degree of collaboration. You probably have some real rock stars on that team. And you probably have a pretty strong leader in the situational loyalist team. The challenge is those relationships are conditional. And they're often conditional on I'll start to change or I'll engage differently when I see the leader take the lead on that.
Right.
Or I'll do this for you when I see you give that to me.
So what's it? Quid pro.
Absolutely quid pro quo. It's that mindset of meeting me partway.
Yeah.
And the biggest difference between a situational loyalist team and a loyalist team is that nature of conditionality.
Okay.
As a loyalist, I don't need anything from you, zero, in order for me to show up as my best.
Right. Right.
Whereas for situational loyalist teams, there's always a condition there.
I do a really interesting and fun exercise. I just did it with a client recently, a nonprofit client, where I have people think about think about the best team you've been on, the worst team you're on, what happened, what did the people do, what the leaders do. But this one's kind of fun. It's a nonverbal exercise. So I have people at tables get up with a flip chart, and they're supposed to draw a picture of their team as a water-going vessel, but they can't talk. And everybody, there's several ground rules. It has to be a water-going vessel, so it could be a life raft, a tanker, it could be a yacht, it could be a catamaran, anything they want it to be. And it has to include the weather, the climate, what's in the water kind of thing. And also that everybody has to participate in some way. And it's nonverbal. And these pictures are so funny. Because you'll see the saboteur team, the unintentional saboteur team. You'll see a bit of the loyals team. Maybe they're in stormy weather right now with the competition as shark. And sometimes they had customers as sharks. And they had people left on the dock. They had people hanging off the crow's nest at the top.
I mean,
hysterically funny. And then we have that conversation about, so what is a great team and how do you create it? So it's really a fun exercise. And the pictures are classic.
I may steal that one with pride.
Yeah, please do.
We're doing
please.
That. That sounds fun.
It is really fun. And then you really get down to the point of, well, why is somebody who's the person left on the dock? Right? Oh, you have all the leaders on the front of the team and the rest of the team on the back rowing in the opposite direction.
Are there any ever in a lifeboat?
There's some in a lifeboat. There's some that are going downstream. And what I say to people is that I said, when you have a really great high-performance team, you've got everybody in the boat faced in the right direction with the right size oars and all rowing in synchronicity. And all you need to do as a leader is count the beats.
Yep.
I'm a rowing freak. I was on the Singapore American rowing team, and I loved it when I lived in Asia. It was a blast. And if you don't row in the same direction at the same pace, you get wet, and you don't win very many races. So it's just a fun way of looking
at it. May even end up going in circles.
Yeah. So we talked about this. What are some of the characteristics of that toxic team, and what do you do about it if you're on that team?
So one of the biggest characteristics of the saboteur team that we've been talking a lot about just recently is the nature of gossiping that happens on the team. That's been a big topic of conversation, where instead of talking to the person I have a problem with, I talk about them.
And you talk about everybody else that can do nothing to change the situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we talk about, and one of the reasons we wrote the book, is we believe that everyone has an opportunity to impact and influence their environment. And so if you find yourself in one of those toxic teams, it's around taking that step to start to change your environment. And the first place we ask you to look is, how are you contributing to that toxicity? What behaviors are you actively engaging in? And what behaviors may you be passively engaging in that are really building that toxic environment?
Or simply just tolerating it.
Well, tolerating it oftentimes, and the silence that comes with toleration, oftentimes is taken as agreement, assent to the situation.
Yeah, I always tell people that, you know, silence is not agreement.
Well, and one of the things that we see is it really just takes one saboteur on the team for everyone else to start to behave a little bit like a saboteur.
That old, the one bad apple spoils the whole barrel.
That's right. Because what then happens is, rather than dealing with it, or, you know, that's when you move into gossip. That's when you move into covering yourself. That's when you move into trying to point out everything that's not working in an underhanded way.
Right.
As opposed to a productive, healthy way where you can address it up front, talk about it, try to work through it. But saboteur teams often stay that way for quite some period of time until people leave.
Yeah. Or until maybe the leader has the courage to recognize the saboteur.
Yes.
Or saboteurs.
Who that is or who they are.
And what I found really interesting in many clients that I work with is that as managers and leaders, we can't tell the team if we're counseling somebody about their behavior that's inappropriate. We just can't do that. It's just not appropriate as a professional. But a lot of times what I've seen happen is when the leader finally has the courage to fire that person, or in some ways gets that person to leave because they just realize they're not going to be successful, the rest of the team comes to him and says, it's about time you noticed.
Yeah.
We've noticed for years that Susan is the saboteur of this organization. And the other thing, too, is that a lot of companies, I think, are trying to put together high-performance loyalist teams, and they try and do things like consensus. But when they're getting to a consensus agreement, they're taking silence as agreement versus going through and saying, do you agree? Do you agree? And what they end up doing is what I call hall talk, which is a form of gossip. So we're in a team meeting and we agree to a decision. And I go out of the room and say, oh my gosh, that was the dumbest decision I've ever heard.
Yep.
And then that gossip starts. Oh my gosh, why didn't Linda, you're the leader. Why didn't you do something about this?
If you find yourself in a position where the meeting after the meeting is happening, which is what you're talking
about. The
hall
talk, yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely on a team that is not productive.
Okay.
Now, whether it's as bad as saboteur, I don't know, but it's certainly a characteristic that you need to start to address.
Okay, great. So we're going to take a quick commercial break, but first, the book is called The Loyalist Team, How Trust, Candor, and Authenticity Create Great Organizations and Really Make a Difference. And if one of you could tell us how we get in touch with you, and how to get your website, and please spell Trispectus.
Okay.
Trispectus. See, I did it.
So theloyalistteam.com is where you can get a lot more information on the book and our assessments. If you're interested in understanding more about our services, it would be www.trispectivegroup, and that is TRISPECTIVE group.com.
And your email is Linda at Trispective.
Yep.
And Abby.
At TrispectiveGroup.com.
Okay, and it's A-B-B-Y.
Yep.
Okay. Awesome. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we're going to come back and dive into this more. I want to hear more about what the leader can do and also about your assessment tools. I'd love to hear about that. So we'll take a quick break.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
When it comes to pioneers in their respective industries, we all know the Apples, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of the world. In the realm of recruiting, Decision Toolbox is the industry's best-kept secret. With 90% of their business from referrals and repeat customers, for over 20 years, Decision Toolbox's U.S.-based team of recruiters, sourcers, professional writers, quality personnel, and tech support has perfected a Six Sigma approach to talent management. No matter the size of the project, Decision Toolbox delivers incredible results. A cost per hire less than half of what contingency firms charge, with the winning candidate presented in an average of 14 days, all with a 12-month candidate warranty. With results like that, Decision Toolbox won't be a secret for long. Visit us at www.dtoolbox.com for more information.
All right, back to Patty and her guests.
And I'm back with Linda and Abby, and they are authors of the book, The Loyalist Team. And we're talking about how great leaders can build loyalist team, but also how great people can be part of a loyalist team and what that feels like. And I think we've all been there. We've all been on great teams, and we've all been on the team from hell. So that's kind of interesting. So what are the characteristics of a great leader, and, you know, how are they able to consistently build loyalist teams? You know, you can build a team around a problem or a challenge, like let's go take this competition, but how can a leader consistently do that, and what are the characteristics?
So I think the first thing I would say is the best leaders that we work with, especially the ones that have great teams, they know that making a team great takes a lot of work.
Yeah, there's called teamwork for a reason.
Exactly. It doesn't just happen. They know it. They understand it. They respect that it takes work. There's a process around it, and that they need to give it time and they need to give it commitment. I think, you know, those that are really effective at leading teams, they set the rules of the road. They put the operating norms in place for the team. They set a high bar for how the team's going to interact, how they're going to behave, how they're going to get work done. They have a cadence around the way they get work done. And the goals are very clear. You know, the other big thing, and I see this all the time working with top teams, is if I'm working with a CEO that doesn't like to create role clarity.
Yep.
It's these high paid executives trying to figure out how to make their way. And it doesn't have to be the executive team. It can be any team.
Mm-hmm.
Cause people want to make a difference and they want to show up and be successful. But when you're not sure where the lines are, that's when, leaders need to step in and they need to help create that clarity.
I actually worked for one senior leader when I worked at the bank, and there were five VPs that all reported to him, and he didn't believe in setting goals, expectations, performance appraisal, because he thought it limited people's creativity. So as a team, we figured, you know what, we can manage up, we can manage Dave and ask for more clarity, and he's going to say, I want you all to go figure it out. I'm paying you to be VPs, you need to go figure it out. So we formed a breakfast club. We met every Friday at 7:30 for breakfast, and we'd all say, now, what did Dave tell you to do, and what did he tell you to do? And we sort of managed around him. We were the most successful team. We still talk to each other. That was 30 years ago. We still think about the good old days when we worked in San Diego and we managed this incredible team and just broke down every barrier. In absence of that strong leader, we managed around him.
Yep. Well, and, you know, it's interesting, our research, when we were able to take our, you know, 6 or 7 years of research from our assessments and look at it, we always have said the number one reason a team works is because the leader is great. And what the research actually told us is really the number one reason is the relationships and the team's ability to come together.
Right.
To do what they need to do. And your example is exactly that.
Yeah. And so how does a leader consistently build that? Because what if you are promoted to be a leader of a team that's a hell team or a dysfunctional team or a saboteur team. What do you do as a leader if you walk into this team from hell?
So the first thing you do is be really clear about your expectations. So, you know, Abby talked about getting clear on roles and responsibilities.
Right.
Very important, but be really clear on your expectations. And then be consistent around modeling the behaviors and expectations that you've established yourself, and then holding others accountable. So not letting it slip once or twice, really dealing with it in the moment. But a big part of being a loyalist team is coming in and co-opting everyone to be on that team with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what you guys did in your right. in your example. Right. You co-opted each other to be on this loyalist team.
Yeah.
So we would encourage leaders to do that too. They can't get there by sheer dint of their personality. The whole team has to be on board with the notion of this is what we want, this is how we're going to get there, and we're going to hold each other accountable to do that.
So how do you deal with the issue of, so I think, and I've struggled with this myself with some of my clients, especially at the senior management level. They hear all, they read all these magazines, they see all these books, and I say one of the dangers is when your executive gets on an airplane and starts reading magazines and books, because they come back, and the VP, the executive vice president I was just talking about, came back from a conference in Connecticut, a banking conference, and came back and said, I want you to fix customer service, because we were really bad. And I said, well, how would you like me? He said, I don't care, just effing fix it. So I had to go figure this whole thing out. So that getting on a magazine and seeing the latest shiny object thing they need to do. But sometimes some of the executives, I think, get it intellectually that they need to have great teams throughout the whole company.
But they don't know how to do it.
They either don't know how to do it or it's not changing their behavior.
Correct.
So they don't get it down here in the heart or in the gut that this is the only way they're going to survive in today's disruptive environment. So how do you get senior executives to see that?
Well, it's actually really interesting. So, you know, one of the things, and when you work with those that don't naturally have it, like they get it, but they don't.
They kind of get it.
They get it, but it's not in them necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of the ways is helping them see research too.
Yeah.
You know, they can, you know, facts, they're more analytical. If they can understand how much a high-performing team can actually shift the results, that can connect with them. You know, I think, you know, one of the ways we always do, we use our assessment.
Yeah.
So, you know, people like data, and you can act on data.
Yeah.
And so we have a proven assessment that we've worked with that allows teams to basically get a 360 view. So it assesses the team assesses the leader, and then a group of stakeholders are asked to assess the team. And with that,
that's awesome.
You know, and sometimes it's, you know, you can't run from the data.
Yeah.
So in the assessment that Abby mentioned, and we've got probably about 6 or 7 years worth of data in there now with hundreds of teams across multiple industries, we've identified some clear characteristics of loyalist teams. And oftentimes when we go in to work with teams, we hear things like we can't get decisions made, or decisions get done over, or we're not fast enough, or we're not agile enough. What we know with loyalist teams is that loyalist teams are 292 times more likely to have those tough conversations than teams that are not.
292 times.
292 yes. times more likely.
Not 93, not 95.
292. it might sound specious when we say 0.4, but no, it really is 292. and we also know that loyalist teams are 106 times more likely to provide tough feedback. And without that feedback, people run off cliffs, they run into buzzsaws, they run down dead ends. And particularly in an environment where you're looking to be fast and agile and innovative, mm-hmm. you have to be able to move quickly.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to adjust quickly.
Yeah.
So without those tough conversations and without that feedback, you're spinning and you're really not going anywhere fast.
I use the picture of, if people remember this from the Ed Sullivan Show, that will date us. Maybe not you, but the old Ed Sullivan show.
Thank you for that,
and Paul in the room is the guy spinning the plates.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So there was, I'll give the visual of, there was this comedian that would be on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he'd have all these plates on sticks, dinner plates, glass yep. dinner plates. And he'd start spinning one, and then he'd spin another one, and all of a sudden the first one goes down. And so, in essence, executives are sort of like spinning plates right
Absolutely.
Now, trying to find mm-hmm. that next innovation that's going to make them the competitive edge. And it sounds like having a loyalist teams is one of the key factors.
I don't believe it's one of the key factors. I believe it is
the
key
factor.
Absolutely.
And the thing that I think leaders are starting to come to understand today is what they've often viewed as the soft side of the business is the hardest thing to do. What was that number that you threw out there that Gallup said was being left on the table?
$450 billion.
Okay.
Billion.
Big, big number. And that's because the soft side of the business, these relationship
right.
aspects are not being attended to.
So you just hit on one of my hot buttons, because I just had a conversation with somebody in education where they called it business skills or soft skills. There's nothing soft about leadership.
No.
There's nothing soft about being a team. I've changed it to be professional skills. Probably that's not even good enough, but because it's not a soft skill to be a great leader and have the courage to confront those
yeah.
saboteurs, to stand in front of the team and say, here's our data, and the data says we're dysfunctional.
Yep.
Does your data show the gap between them and the best performing companies so they can actually see the gap?
So we haven't done that on a company by company basis.
Yeah.
It really is around team to team.
Team to team. Okay.
And so you can measure your effectiveness as a team dependent on where you are on that
yeah.
spectrum.
Yeah. It's interesting because what I tell leaders is if there's a gap, like if your team is, you know, if your team's here and it's supposed to be here, that's the space for leaders to take action.
Yep.
That's the space to put in some kind of an improvement plan, to work on it, to do something, to change the ratio. So a lot of people have remote teams nowadays, right? So a lot of companies, when I worked at Microsoft, people I worked with, people I led might be in, my manager was in Madrid, my teammates were in Fargo, my other teammates were in Mexico City. So how does a leader manage a remote team in that environment?
So we're seeing it everywhere too.
Yeah.
All of our clients, especially our global clients.
Yeah. They're everywhere.
They're all over the world. And you know, what the best leaders do, what the best teams do, is they fully respect the fact that they've got to work a lot harder to make that team work. You know, I mean, a couple of the things that are really critical, right, is you sort of live and die by email.
Email and now Skype or Zoom
exactly.
or any kind of video conference.
But you know, when one group's working, the other group might be sleeping.
Yep, been there.
And so, you know, what happens is you've got to find a way to have regular and effective communication. You still have to put those ground rules in place.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they can look different for those types of teams, right? There are specific things they need to do. Like, you've got to have rules around about response time. You've got to have rules about when you're going to talk. You know, one of the things that when I worked at Newmont, we actually did what we called share the pain. And so rather than it being, you know, the leader or the executive or whoever's in, you know, the most critical role, determine what time the meetings are,
mm-hmm.
is you just do a share the pain. So
yep,
that
we did it.
And it makes a huge difference, too. It just, you know, respects the team more.
Yeah. When I was in Worldwide Worlds at Microsoft, I had 2 conference calls a day. I'd have one in the morning where I'd get most of the U.S., Latin America, Europe. And I'd have an even late afternoon evening call for Asia, mm-hmm. China, Australia, and all those kind of organizations. And then that would be on a regular basis. And at least quarterly, we'd have one meeting where we shared the pain. So I have this funny story. I was working in Singapore, and I'm on this call at midnight. And I'm on the call, and I literally fell asleep. I started out sort of like this, you know, with the phone close to my ear, and I'm sitting up, and pretty soon I'm sort of leaning over, and pretty soon I'm laying on the couch.
Yeah.
And I hear somebody's, Patty, are you there? But
oh,
yeah, that you
yeah.
you have a way.
What was your response? Sorry, I was on mute.
Oh, sorry, I was talking, I was on mute. You're right. You're exactly right.
Well, so one of the things that often happens with these remote teams is people are trying to get 2 things done at once. So it's like, oh, well, I'll get on this call and I'll get all my email done and I'll finish this document. And so one of the ground rules I see a lot of teams today do is they say you have to be fully engaged.
No laptops,
exactly.
No phones in the meetings.
And if you're on the phone, be part of the conversation on the phone. Don't be trying to, you know, get through all your emails.
Yeah. Now, I actually heard that science proved this, and I have some people challenge it, that your mind cannot hold two thoughts at the same time, that you cannot be fully engaged in a conversation and doing email at the same time, that biologically it's impossible.
Yeah.
And they said if you're trying to do that, that was the equivalent of trying to work and have two glasses of wine or smoke a marijuana cigarette. I mean,
you can do that in California now.
You can do that in Washington,
Colorado. Yeah. Well, so it's interesting. We actually had, when I was at Newmont, when I was the VP of talent, we had Bain come in, and they did this big assessment of how people were spending their time. And what they did is they basically looked at our Outlook calendars and our email activity. And they can do this analysis where they essentially show how many people are sitting in meetings and you know, how much time are people in meetings, and how many of them are doing their emails while they're in these meetings. And you know, of course, and I think like every company, it's ridiculous.
You can't multitask.
No. But everybody's doing it. And I think it really undermines the effectiveness of teams and the ability to problem solve together, to really understand each other's challenges, to make sure you're having the right conversations. And it's just part of a loyalist team does that. And so teams have to be disciplined, I think, about that.
Yeah, and it goes back to that definition from Wisdom of Teams by Kazenbach and Smith about it's a team with a common goal, a common approach to operating. Now, those can be operating principles, ground rules, values, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call them, that there are very certain things. One that, you know, as simple as meetings start on time and end on time, yeah. that we don't multitask during the meeting.
Yep.
We're fully engaged. We're participating. Those are practical things you can put in place. But the team needs to have that vision and goal that everybody's striving for together, so they are rowing the boat kind of in the same direction.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're on a team and you're not clear what the goals are, or you don't think everybody's on the same page, you got to say it.
You got to say something.
Yep.
So you were talking about the operating norms. Both you and Abby were going through those. There are some very pragmatic operating norms, as you've suggested. But we also encourage teams to take a look at what are some of the behavioral norms that they might want to
add. No hall talk one.
That definitely one of them. The other two, though, that we think and we found in our work there are really transformational if people can embrace them. The first is around this notion of extending trust, not waiting for trust to be earned. And my granny used to say, you know, trust is earned in inches and lost in miles.
Yeah, and lost in one statement sometimes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so extending trust is definitely characteristic of a high-performance team. And this notion of assuming positive intent. So if you're doing something that I don't understand, if you're engaging in a way that I'm not clear around, my
or
first
that I don't like.
Or I disagree with.
Yeah.
The first rule I have to go to is I'm going to assume positive intent on your part. I'm not going to ascribe some negative behavior around you're running your agenda, you're trying to put me down. If I can't assume positive intent on my own, then the obligation is for me to come and sit with you and really understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And maybe it's insight you don't have, maybe it's insight I don't have, but to have that conversation. So those are two softer but critical elements.
I agree 100% because you know, one of the ground rules could be if you've got a problem or issue with someone, you go directly to them.
Yep.
You don't
yep.
bring it to the team. You don't bring it to somebody else. And the way you can say something to someone, an individual, say, I'm not sure you noticed, but during the meeting, every time I tried to bring up an idea, you shot me down.
Mm-hmm.
And be very specific. Not you were picking up. This will be very specific. So in the meeting, what I noticed was that every time I tried to say something, you shot me down. I know you didn't intend that, but that's how it was on my end. And sometimes people go, if they're on a loyalist team, if they're a loyal team member, they're going to say, thank you. I didn't realize I did that. Because there's that blind spot we all have that we know what we see, others see things we don't see, but there's just some huge blind spots that are there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what are the things that can trip up a loyalist team? Because teams take work. Mm-hmm. I always say it's team work, and I always have it team, and then work is capitalized. It takes a lot of work. You can't just put together a team once and assume you got it. So what are some of the things that trip up these high-performing loyalist teams, and then what can individuals or leaders do about that?
So being a loyalist team in and of itself can be the challenge. It's like we've reached nirvana. We have the team of our dreams and everything is going great. And I really don't want to risk screwing it up.
And what if somebody leaves or somebody new comes in? Who does the orientation with the new? All that stuff.
And so getting complacent around this is great. Being afraid to have those tough conversations because things are so good.
Right.
That's probably the single biggest hurdle that we see our clients have to get beyond. And we actually have one client organization who is in that space, who the CEO demands relentless candor and the ability to be able to engage in giving each other feedback, and has built it into their team sessions.
Yeah. So what about leaders who say those things? We've all heard walk the talk. What about leaders who say all the right things? You know, they'll say they have an open door policy, but they have a closed mind. Or they say they want this candor, but when somebody comes to them with real feedback, that they shoot the messenger. So how do you deal with that?
So it depends whether you're a colleague of that team leader or whether you're a team member. But I think in both cases, in both cases, you really have an obligation to have a conversation. And it's certainly tougher to have when you're the team member. But I think getting in that space where you know the leader has the commitment, he said the words, she said the words, to say, I'm really struggling to line up your actions with your words. And I'm confused by what I'm seeing here.
I like the way, can you say that again? I like the way you said that. I'm confused by
the way your actions line up with what you're telling us with your words.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the message is here. Can you help me understand it?
Yeah, and as leaders, we really have to watch everything we say.
You're in the fishbowl, always.
Always. I'll use a funny example when I have a sarcastic sense of humor that you may or may not realize, but I have a sarcastic sense of humor. And, you know, I had an employee come to me one time when I was working in a bank, in a retail bank where people are coming in. It was a very busy day, and the ground rule was you don't shut your teller window unless the building's on fire or something really bad has happened. You just, because there were so many people in line and we had scheduled breaks and things. This one brand new teller came up to me. I was the operations manager, and she said, Patty, I need to go to the bathroom. Well, my sarcastic sense of humor kicked in, and I said, I'm sorry, you'll have to use your trash can. True story. She came back to me about 10 minutes later and said, I can't use my trash can. I have on a jumpsuit. Otherwise, my teller would have squatted in their trash can in the public library. So you have to watch everything you say.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, often too, you know, people are looking. They want direction. You show up to work to do a great job. You show up to work to get recognized for making an impact. And you want to do what your boss, you know, is going to make your boss happy. So if your boss tells you to be in a trash can, right, you know, you think, oh, goodness, right? I know the rules of the road here. So that's an interesting story. But I do think, you know, this idea of being courageous enough to find a tactful way to have really tough conversations is part of growing into being a loyalist team. You know, what we find loyalist teams, they don't struggle with it as much.
Right.
It's always tough to deliver bad news, and it doesn't matter how much trust you have. You know, but I've got four partners, and we are very much a loyalist team, but we have moments, right, when we need to give each other some tough feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there are different things that have come up that we've had to really work through, and it's just as hard on a loyalist team to be brave enough to say things that you know might hurt someone else in hearing it or possibly harm the relationship. Loyalist teams have less fear of it harming the relationship, which is one of the distinctions, but you have to build to that too.
You have to build that trust. And I know a lot of times I tell people to state intent before content.
Mm-hmm.
So I might say, you know, Linda, you may not be aware in this client meeting, here's what happened. You know, I just wanted to bring this to your awareness and kind of, you know, say intent. My intent is to give you information of something that you may have not seen that happened in this client meeting, in this team meeting, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah. And we always encourage people too to say, if it really is hard, often just say, this is really hard for me to share with you.
I might not say this right. And you know, I apologize in advance if this is clunky or if I hurt your feelings. But here's my intent.
Yeah,
I really want to have us be in a better place.
Well, and if the leader models that behavior, then the team the team models that behavior themselves.
Yes.
Excuse me. If they see the leader admitting this is hard for me, then they're willing to do it too.
Well, this idea of vulnerability.
right, is a huge part of what leaders of loyalist teams do, right? They never claim to know it all, have it right. You know, they're struggling to solve difficult problems too. And being able to put that back out to your team and say it and talk about it, ask the team to help you do it is such a great way to model the fact that it takes a team, it takes a village to, you know, innovate, to solve tough problems, to get through the challenges that come up at work and in business.
So loyalist teams need leaders who the word I would use from your book.
Authentic.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. They need to show that authentic side and say, you know, I need your help.
Yep.
Right?
Absolutely.
How does diversity and team style come into place with loyalist teams?
So the option is whether or not you choose to lean into that diversity and leverage it and have it be a strength for the team.
Right.
Or whether you allow that diversity to actually create tension and friction on the team. And loyalist teams really do understand that diversity is so much broader than whether it's skin color or gender or country of origin. It's also diversity of approach, diversity of thought, how you process information and make decisions. And in our team sessions, we do work around just that, where we have team members take personality assessments and use those not because that's a hard science, but because it does provide some insights around what those preferences are and an opportunity for the team to explore where those preferences can collide and where those preferences can come together in a way that's much more constructive.
Every team I ever led and managed in my entire career, I always did Myers-Briggs, personality assessment, DISC, D-I-S-C, Strength Finder, Platinum Rule. I've used probably everyone on the market and simply done it in a fun way to understand how people work, how they prefer to think, act, and talk. Are they direct versus indirect? Are they task or people focused? To get people to really understand about what it really means to be part of that, because a loyalist team needs everybody.
Yep.
All different backgrounds. So a couple of last questions before we run out of time. Why did you guys write the book?
So we wrote the book because we really felt that we had something to share around an understanding and approach around how to build great teams and this passion that we have that everybody deserves a great team experience and a belief that every team has the potential to be great. And without the book, our reach was kind of limited to the number of hours we have to get in front of clients.
Right.
And this is an opportunity to really send that out to the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm going to ask both of you, what is your last word of advice for leaders out there, team members out there, about how to be part of a loyalist team, how to create whatever you'd like to discuss. And then we'll go one more time about the book and how people can get in touch with you.
You know, I think the big piece of advice I would have is really own it. Right. If you be committed to building a great team, you show up and spend a lot of hours at work, make it great and work at it. Be willing to say what you need to say. Show up as yourself. Be authentic and work hard to create a great team. Don't just passively sit back and accept status quo.
OK, great. Great words of advice.
And Linda? The notion that if you understand that only 15% or so of the teams out there are loyalist teams, if you don't have what you want where you're at today, chances are you're not going to leave and walk into that great team out the door. So work with what you have. And to the extent that you can't create the environment that you want, trust me, you will have learned something about yourself. You'll have gained new skills around what it is to really show up as a loyalist. And you'll take that with you into your next interview, into your next job.
Right.
And you'll find that team of your dreams.
Yeah. I always, one of the best team building activities I ever found was not doing high ropes and all these team building kinds of things. And I know.
Yeah, we don't do those.
We don't do those things. No, we don't do those things. Those are temporary. But one of the best things I found is I always manage the volunteer day or events where we get people together at a volunteer activity. Mm-hmm. We're painting houses. We're building roads. We're doing something outside our normal environment. You see people dress differently, think differently. You get to meet people in a different environment. You learn something about them you didn't know, and it really helps kind of build that team spirit. And then you have a common thing that you remember. You know, remember when we painted that house? It's really kind of
that
a
shared
cool thing.
Experience.
That shared experience is really important. So one last time, the book is called The Loyalist Team, How to How Trust, Candor, and Authenticity Create Great Organizations. You need to pick this up on Amazon. And one last time, Linda and Abby, how do we get in touch with you and your website?
So it's Linda or Abby at trispectivegroup.com. And I would encourage your listeners to think about, if you're interested in the team that you're on today, go and take our free assessment. It takes less than 5 minutes. Just go to takesnapshot.com.
Takesnapshot.com.
You got it. And you will find out in 5 minutes, based on your perspective, which one of those four team types you're on.
Okay.
And there's some ideas and advice on there around what you can do to change where you're at if you're looking to change it.
Well, thank you for offering the free assessment. And one more time, website, and please spell Trispective.
It's TRISPECTIVE group.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you, ladies, and thank you for traveling all
thank
the way
you,
from
Patty.
Colorado, El Paso to be here today. We're going to go have a fun lunch. So just a couple of things to the audience. One, thank you so much for listening. I always tell people to listen, learn, and lead. So take what you're learning here and apply it to your environment. If you want to get in touch with me, my email is pattygrimm@live.com, and that's PattyGrimm at live.com. My website is www.advantage-training.com. And if you want to pick up my book on Amazon, it's Quiet Women Never Change History, Be Strong, Stand Up, Stand Out, and Let's Go Kick Some Glass. So thank you, ladies, and this has been a rockin' show.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Women Kicking Glass, the only radio show on OC Talk Radio dedicated to empowering women to be the best they can be. Listen each week or download the podcast at patty.grimm.podbean.com. To reach out to Patty to schedule a speech webinar or to learn more about her leadership and team training, contact Patty at pattygrimm@live.com. For more information about her company and her books, have a kicking day.